From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour, starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nand. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a contributing writer for Washington City Paper. Tom Sherwood, welcome.
Good afternoon.
Later in the broadcast, we'll be talking with the Chief of Police of the Metropolitan Police Department of the District of Columbia, Peter Newsham. But of course, first we'll be talking about Virginia. So if you have any opinion or question or comment about the latest events in Virginia over the past week or so, you can start calling now. Briefly first, Tom Sherwood, let's talk Maryland. It seems that the ever-popular Maryland Governor Larry Hogan is running into some problems, challenging his initiatives both in the House and in the Senate. In the House, it has to do with giving counties power to veto the governor's plan to toll the Beltway and I-270. That proposal in the House would essentially give counties the power to veto state toll projects. That from reporting from Luz Lazo in the Washington Post. On the Senate side, it is well known that the governor does not like starting school before Labor Day and had a mandate not to do that. But on the Senate side, they're voting along party lines to preliminary approve a bill that allows local school districts to set their own calendars. And the governor, in response to that, said, heck, I'll call for a referendum because I'm popular, Larry Hogan.
Well, Hogan is no doubt popular, but I'm not sure, you know, starting school after Labor Day is necessarily that popular. But, you know, Bruce DePort in Maryland Matters has also written about the transportation issue. The Senate and the House were to pass this law. It's in effect in other parts of the state. It's not something unusual. But if Montgomery County or Prince George's County, Howard or any of these local counties have the chance to overrule major highway projects like Governor Hogan's $9 billion project, I mean, what if Montgomery County says yes and Prince George's says no? The highway state secretary Pete Ron said it's a recipe for dysfunction. You know, so but it just tells you how controversial adding lanes to 270 and the 495 toll lanes, roads that people have already thought they'd already paid for through gas taxes are now having to pay. So that's really a mess. But as for schools, I don't doubt that Governor Hogan could get a referendum up pretty quickly, whatever the law allows. I'm not so sure people like going back to school necessarily after Labor Day.
Because not necessarily everybody is running to Ocean City for Labor Day weekend. No, and this legislation
It's called the Ocean City, you know, staff bill.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's an important issue. Some people are saying children should be going to school all year round, not just after Labor Day.
Joining us in studio is Toni Michelle Travis. She's the editor of the Almanac of Virginia Politics. She's a professor of political science in the Schar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University. Toni Michelle, good to see you again.
Thank you.
And joining us by phone is Jordan Pascal. He's a transportation reporter with WAMU 88.5. Jordan, thank you for joining us.
Hey, Kojo.
Jordan, you've spent the last few days in Richmond, where we have the governor, the attorney general, and the Senate majority leader all caught up in scandals having to do with blackface, and the lieutenant governor in a scandal having to do with sexual assault. How has that affected the mood there in Richmond over the past week?
Yeah, well, I covered the General Assembly the past 2 years, and this week has been really, really different. It's been heavy and emotional. Democrats are really kind of at a loss at this point because, I mean, you think you've got those three major scandals to hit you in less than a week. There's just a lot of weight for people. And because of that, you know, I think a lot of people are just in shock right now. Even the folks that, you know, I've known for a couple of years aren't willing to talk on the record just because stuff's moving fast and they don't really know what to say. And you've got 40, 50 news outlets clogging the hall from all over the country. So, you know, just a lot of upheaval. A lot of the regular activities are different. There's an annual House and Senate basketball game that raises money for charity, and Northam and Fairfax played in it last year. Northam played in it for years, and neither were there. So a lot of attention, and I think a lot of lawmakers are, you know, kind of ready to go back for the weekend to their home districts and kind of process what's happened this week.
Jordan Tom Sherwood. You covered the legislature for the Norfolk. What news organization was it?
Yeah, so I covered the General Assembly for the Virginian Pilot, which is down in Hampton Roads, Norfolk, Virginia Beach area.
You know, we haven't heard from the governor for a while. The Attorney General, Mark Herring, put out that strong statement where he apologized for what he had done. There's some suggestion that there is unity in numbers, and that while everyone thought the governor was going to resign last Saturday and he didn't, and now he's fighting to stay in office and show that he had nothing to do with that picture. There's some feeling that maybe all three of them will not be leaving office. Is there any sense of that at all? That they maybe,
yeah,
it's all, everyone's wounded, but no one's going to be fatally have their career ended.
Yeah, I think that's what a lot of people are talking about, the State House, is that it's almost, you know, given people cover, because there's so much to, you know, there's so much that's been uncovered, and it seems like something new every day. And so the attention is, you know, shifted away from Northam. And, you know, we haven't heard from him since Saturday. So, you know, that's 5-6 days. And so I think, you know, his camp is just hoping this, you know, maybe blows over and then he can stay in office and, you know, hopefully go out on some sort of redemption tour.
Yeah.
I can't imagine that goes over well.
Yeah, very quickly, you know, the only thing he's done that's important for people up here in Northern Virginia is he signed the legislation for the Amazon of funds, $750 million.
Yeah.
And that's, he did it. He just, normally that would be a big PR event. He simply
huge
signed
deal.
It.
Tony Michelle Travis.
I'd like to ask, what is being said in Richmond about the timing of all of this in terms of all three of the statewide officials being in this scandal?
In the middle of the legislature.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, Northam's been in politics for more than a decade. Herring's been a known quantity. Fairfax is, you know, newer. But, I mean, you know, these folks have been around, and for all of this to hit at the same time, you know, there's been talks of, you know, how this all started. The big abortion debate last week is kind of what, you know, Washington Post had reported that, you know, it was a concerned classmate that was upset about that. And, you know, gave that tip to a blog, and then, you know, stuff kind of just started to crumble from there. So I think there's definitely some talk of, all right, do we just unload everything while people are down? That's kind of been the chatter.
Because yeah. My concern was, well, who benefits from this if you get rid of, if Northam steps down or if all three step down for any reason?
Who
exactly.
Benefits? Well, the Kirk Cox, the Speaker of the House. General House, would become the governor. But certainly, is it better? I would ask the professor who teaches this and racial matters and George Mason. How does the state get out of this? Whatever levels of trouble each person is in, assuming they all resign or maybe they all stay, what does it do to the state?
Well, it really hurts the state, because I think a number of people thought we were beyond this. But the problem is, I don't think we're teaching enough history, and in this case, Virginia history, as to why something like blackface would be totally unacceptable to the African-American community. But it was pretty standard at fraternity parties and Halloween parties well into the 80s at many universities in Virginia.
Indeed, these controversies are a reminder of Virginia's racial history. So I guess this wasn't very surprising to you, was it?
No, it wasn't, unfortunately.
Yeah, but let's talk about what's going on with the lieutenant governor, Justin Fairfax, because all of the other three leaders have been accused of or have admitted to wearing blackface. In Justin Fairfax's case, there's an allegation of sexual assault that has come from one individual. How does that look at this point?
Well, what I would question there is, why is it that the voice or the statements of one female do not carry enough sway? Why is it we have to have almost a Bill Cosby situation of repeated incidents of this, and 20 women have to come forward before anyone thinks it's a real problem? That's the problem of, where do you draw the line? Is it repeated behavior or one-time behavior?
Go ahead.
This is in the Me Too movement, which has done, I think, a terrific job of shaking the nations of assumption, well, it's just a he said, she said type thing. And certainly even Justin Fairfax, after initially responding, put out, the lieutenant governor put out another statement where he said, let's respect the person who's making this allegation against me. I don't in any way want to demean her, but I want to deny everything she says about it. And the Washington Post did not do an original story because it said it could not do find any corroborating information beyond what the lieutenant governor said and what the woman said. And it only published its story because Justin Fairfax put out yet another statement which mischaracterized why the Post didn't report it. And when he did that, it gave them the opportunity to lay out the entire sordid matter. But how do you, if it is, she says this, he says it didn't happen, and there's no other witnesses, do we have to wait for other instances? Do we have to wait? I mean,
I don't think so. I mean, this is an awful experience for a female to come public with an accusation right. such as this. And I don't think any female would take it lightly. I think she, you know, for whatever reasons, decided this was the time to.
And she did contemporaneously tell other people in her world. This is not something she's just kept to herself
right.
all these years.
This is another California professor, you know, and this is not.
Jordan Pascal, I get the impression that in Richmond, just about everybody is tiptoeing around the allegation against the lieutenant governor. Am I correct?
Yeah, it's been a little bit of a mixed bag. I mean, some of the colleagues in the Senate are, you know, reluctant, waiting to hear more before they comment. But the Virginia Legislative Black Caucus and Virginia's congressional delegation, you know, Keynes, Warner, those folks, they've both called for a thorough investigation by authorities. But, you know, no one really said what type of investigation. It's, you know, 2004 happened in Boston. So, I mean, is this a Massachusetts investigation? Is this a private, you know, person hired by the state? There's no real definition of what that next step will be.
Well, let's hear what Delegate Mark Keem has to say. Delegate Keem represents the 35th District in Virginia's House of Delegates. He joins us by phone. Delegate Keem, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you, Kojo.
What's your take on all of this?
Well, first of all, it's been a pretty interesting week in Richmond, and I am very, very sorry that all of us as Virginians are having to deal with these issues instead of all the really important things that we have been working on. Just about an hour ago, I came out of our House Finance Committee where we passed a bill that would deal with our tax conformity. As you know, President Trump and the Republicans last 2 years ago pushed through a tax cut, which really helps benefit the richest people. So we've tried really hard to make sure that at the state level we can have some balance, and so we just passed a bill that does provide some more balance for the lower income folks. But these are conversations that we were hoping to have and engage our public about. But unfortunately, of course, everybody's been concerned about the political scandals. And rightfully so, I understand that people are concerned about the uncertainties. But the reality is the governing has continued and does continue throughout. And in a bipartisan way, we are able to work on policy while we, you know, try to do what we can to deal with the political scandals.
You're not in the Senate, you're in the House of Delegates, but what is your view of the Justin Fairfax matter, which is separate from the racial issues involving Tommy Norman and the governor and the attorney general? Do you have a view on what should happen next? If you were advising the lieutenant governor or if you were opposing him, what would you think or say?
Sure, Tom. And this is a very, very tough and sensitive issue. And I want to start by saying I believe that anybody who's willing to come forward as a survivor of sexual assault or any kind of a situation like that, where they are willing to put their personal reputation and private life on the line to get to the truth, I admire that. I respect that. And I believe Dr. Tyson certainly deserves all of our attention and make sure that she has the right opportunity to air all of her concerns. And so I want to see and hear more from obviously both parties, but in particular I'm very sensitive to where Dr. Tyson's coming from, and I thank her for willing to step forward and come forward and present the evidence. It is, as you've just had the conversation, it's somewhat unprecedented because, number one, it happened so long ago and it didn't happen in our state, so we don't have the same venues or vehicles by which we can investigate, because this isn't something that we can call the Virginia Commonwealth Attorney to do. This is something outside of state. Given that it is an allegation so far, which, if true, could potentially become a criminal matter as opposed to just a, you know, like a personal scandal, this could possibly raise some legal concerns on both sides, we have to be a little bit more careful than the governor or the attorney general, whose allegations, no matter how horrendous it is, it doesn't rise to the level of a criminal or legal matter. So I think we have to, at least in our minds, keep those two categories separate, that when we're talking about something that might have legal or criminal implications, we just can't come out and say things without really making sure that we're not impacting the legal process. Whereas with the governor and the attorney general, it's a lot easier for us to say we think it's abhorrent, it's racist, and that's not the kind of behavior we expect from our elected officials.
But this is the politics hour. Let's get to the politics. I talked to Tom Davis, the former Northern Virginia Republican congressman, seven terms in the House, as he liked to say, seven terms undefeated and unindicted. But what does it mean? All the 140 seats of the legislature are up this fall, the 40 seats in the Senate, 100 seats in the House. Politically, how is this going to, I realize you don't know the end of the scandal, so it's hard to say, but this seems it's got to hurt the Democratic Party, which has been on a roll since 2 years ago, 2017 and 2018. You won all those seats. What is happening for the elections? And then I also asked the professor to answer that, too.
Well, sure, and that's certainly a good question for all of us to be asking, especially people like me who are going to have our names on the ballot in November this year. Obviously, it does have an impact, but we'd like to really think that voters out there are not single-issue voters, and certainly people are not voters out there in Virginia are not looking to see where we stand on an issue that's not directly related to what we've been doing in our office. And so to the extent that the governor, lieutenant governor, attorney general, who happen to be of my own political party, are having personal scandals around them, I mean, that is clearly an issue that people will think about and talk about. But does that matter whether your state delegate or state senator has done a good job or a lousy job over the last 2 years or 4 years? That really is what we are putting our names on the ballot for. And I'm proud to stand on my personal record. But at the same time, I want to make sure that voters understand what they will get and what they will not get if they have a Democratic majority. And as somebody who would like to see us in our party in the majority, I can tell you that the policies that we care about, the issues that we're fighting for every day in Richmond, are the issues that a mainstream of Virginians, a majority of Virginians, want us to fight for women's health.
That sounds like a campaign speech.
Here's Tony Michelle Travis.
Okay. I think what we're going to see, and I would agree with Delegate Keem, that the voters will look at people as individuals when it comes time to vote in November. And if their delegate, their state senator's been doing what they wish with their priorities in terms of the budget and in terms of other issues, they will be returned. I think it might hurt the Democratic Party, though, the next time we have to select candidates for those three statewide offices, though.
Well, let's talk about a what-if situation. What if all of these three top leaders, the governor, the lieutenant governor, and the attorney general, resign?
Then Cox, Speaker of the House, ascends.
What happens if none of them resigns?
I think we're going to continue to be in turmoil, but I think we can have governance, and I think the governor can get through the budget and the substantive issues that are under consideration now.
Quentin Kidd, the political professor from Christopher Newport, said that one thing you have to keep in mind is that given the speeded up nature of our world today, he said there could be plenty of more scandals between now and the elections in the fall. He wasn't making light of what's happening now. And also there are voters, suburban women voters, which we've talked a lot about in the last few recent elections. You know, I'm not sure if you take an equivocal answer on Justin Fairfax, well, on the one hand this, on the one hand that, I'm not sure you won't pay a price for that.
I would agree that it'll be very interesting to see where the women in the legislature now are on this issue and where women voters are in the autumn.
Got to move on to our callers. Delegate Keem, thank you so much for joining us.
Sure. Thank you, Coach. Thank you, Tom.
Jordan Pascal, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Here now is EW in Washington, D.C. EW, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yeah. Thank you for taking my call, Coach. I'd just like to say that, you know, this, if any of them are, you know, true, it's a terrible situation, terrible thing that have happened. But one thing that it does, I think, is it poisoned the electric. The population is, I think, kind of fed up with this kind of politics that you go in the past and you grab things and bring them to the future and want the people to make a decision on it. And the lady who was talking earlier talked about, irregardless on what made her bring forth her issue at this time, irregardless of that, I don't know if the public is willing to just forego that. I mean, it seems to be somewhat opportunist. I'm not saying he did it or he didn't, but it could have very well been brought out many months ago, many years ago. I understand this happened some time ago. But it just goes to show you where our politics has gone, and our politics of the future, because we're going numb to it, is not going to be concerned about what has happened in the past. And though I'm not a Trump supporter, I think largely that's what overtook his supporters. Is that,
well, let me ask Tony Michelle Travis, because the lieutenant governor himself at one point said, you see the timing of this? Do you think that this is coincidental?
I don't in any way. That's a traumatic experience for any female to undergo. And it takes years to process it for yourself and to come to some conclusion about it. And I think maybe she just heard about something and it triggered it in her mind and she came forth. She came forth a long time ago with the Washington Post, really.
Yes, when he was running for lieutenant governor.
Yes.
This incident, just for everyone to know, 2004 in Boston during the Democratic Convention, where it began as a consensual gathering together, and then Fairfax became more aggressive in the sexual context.
Here's Vivian in Falls Church, Virginia. Vivian, your turn.
Thank you. I guess I'm one of those suburban white women.
You guess?
Yeah, I guess I am. I know.
Just
I am.
Be clear. I said suburban women. I didn't say anything about the race.
Okay. Fine. Anyway, this is actually. I'm not going to speak to that specifically. I make a general statement. No one should resign. I find a question for you. Has anyone in the past week come forward to say that Ralph Northam, either in the past 35 years or even in 1984, displayed to them any indication in word or deed that he was abusive, prejudicial in any way? His classmates who have been interviewed, black and white, are mystified by this. It's not facially self-evident that he is in that photograph. But, of course, one may ask, why is it there? What is it about? And there are facts that we don't know. I don't know if we will ever know them. But I don't think action should be taken on the basis of suspicion or somebody.
Well, Mark Herring, there's no suspicion. There's no suspicion with Mark Herring. He came right out and said, I did it.
Well, I don't believe that is a situation that should warrant a resignation.
How about the situation of Justin Fairfax, the lieutenant governor?
I think that in that case, it's a legal matter. I believe she came forward with that very graphic statement on Wednesday because he said something on Monday. He actually did threaten to sue her, or he threw it out there. And he also was so strong on the consensual thing that she got a lawyer.
But
and
you don't think at this point that he should resign yet?
No, I don't think anybody should resign yet. What people may decide to do is up to them. But the frenzy of it, all of it, is poisonous. I think everybody has become, it's just impossible for people to almost even think
we
straight.
We do exist in a somewhat frenzied political environment these days, what with the Twitter president that we have. But
that's a key question in terms of whether that was a continuing pattern of behavior in all three cases.
Yep,
certainly with Northam, no one else has accused him of anything.
Here now is CK, and thank you for your call, Vivian. CK in Arlington, Virginia. CK, your turn.
I think the distinction in the Ford and Tyson cases should be made. Professor Ford, at the time the event occurred allegedly with Justice Kavanaugh, was when she was 16. The event in terms of Professor Tyson is this was a professional woman who agreed on her own statement to go up to his room, and they started kissing, and it led from there. I just feel as though this has been thrown in as part of a feeding frenzy.
What do you think the lieutenant governor should do?
Well, he's going to have to pursue it legally because she has pursued it legally.
Well, they both have legal representation.
That's correct. So,
yeah, but even if the woman went voluntarily, this is where we get to no means no.
Yeah.
Even if a woman or a man goes to a hotel room with another person and with the understanding that whatever she or he thinks is going to happen.
Mike Tyson.
The allegation is that Justin Fairfax forced her to do something she did not want to do. It's not a matter of consent.
Okay, thank you very much for your call. Let's get in Steve in Alexandria, Virginia. Steve, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Kojo. Thanks for taking my call. Long-time listener. I'm really troubled by the fact that this consensus seems to be emerging that somehow three crimes is better than none. And that when we're looking at three people doing these things, all of a sudden they're all going to survive. I mean, that just reeks of just politics. I mean, if the fourth guy in line was a Democrat, these three guys would be gone. If the fourth guy in line is a Republican, then all of a sudden we're talking about redemption and all these other reasons why these guys should stick around. I think the whole thing is just a disaster for Virginia. It just makes us look so juvenile, so parochial.
So you think that all three guys should resign?
Not necessarily, but just a suggestion that as this moves forward, your guests seem to hint that, you know, that they're bloody but not you know, finished. That's disgusting when you think about it. That somehow the three things together are cause for their survival.
Senate Majority Leader Thomas Norman.
Sorry, the other thing about the Me Too stuff here. I'm curious, where are all these Me Too people that are, is anyone going to accost Justin Fairfax on an elevator here to get some...
Well, the National Organization for Women has called on him to resign, but there's an article in the Daily Beast that says that most of the women's organizations at this point are, well, hedging their bets, so to speak.
It's almost all, you know, this needs to be further looked into. But just very quickly on the politics hour, it is real politics that if there are three people with various allegations against them, it muddies the water as to what could or may happen next. So that's just it's not that we're agreeing that we like it on this show, but we're telling you what the politics are.
There's one aspect of this that we have not discussed, and I think that Hugh in Hyattsville, Maryland will raise it. Hugh, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Kojo. Certainly appreciate your show over decades. I'm interested in understanding more about the opposition research that led to the accusation against Northam and whether it was motivated because of his stand on the late-term abortion issue.
I am not sure it was.
That's the basic answer to that is yes, that the guy who published it first was upset at Northam's comments on WTOP radio about late term abortion. And that had Northam perhaps not said anything on that show, this may never have happened.
And that guy that you mentioned said that he was approached by an individual who gave him or showed him the photo from the yearbook. But Tony Michelle Travis, we cannot neglect that. Many of these scandals have come to light because of a conservative website that gentleman works for called Big League Politics. What can you tell us?
Yes, well, when you look at Big League Politics, you find that they may have...
It's one guy, basically.
Yeah, one person.
Just to be clear.
Yes.
Formerly with Breitbart, now with Big League Politics, yes.
May have 500,000 people tuned in. Well, if you have an issue such as this, you can up your numbers pretty quickly, because people say, what other scandals will they uncover? And to say someone's a concerned citizen sounds a bit questionable, I think, as to why, as you raise the question, the timing of this against Northam.
Well, let me say, as a reporter, it doesn't matter to me the motive of the person who is telling me something about a politician. In this case, this may be a very conservative person who's trying to build more political support for the anti-abortion movement in Virginia. But if the information is accurate, then it doesn't really matter where it came from. There's two issues here for the Republicans who are mostly conservative and anti-abortion, is that this could arouse the anti-abortion people in Virginia in this fall's elections. And it could encourage African Americans to stay home.
We got an email from Jennifer who said that the allegations against the lieutenant governor are those of a violent, illegal act. But it is a routine crime that women have to worry about all the time. I feel that this has taken a huge back seat to the blackface situation. Why isn't violence or potential violence against women sensationalized as greatly by the media as a ridiculously offensive but not illegal photograph?
Well, women are still, in ever so many cases, second-class citizens. What they do, what they say, is just never as important as what a male does or says, supposedly.
I think the news media has pretty aggressively covered this ever since it came out. We can say the Post should have said something a year ago or not, but I don't think there's anyone giving the lieutenant governor a pass on this. Do we have another call or I have a question?
No, we only have about another minute, but okay. Go ahead.
I was talking to some both black and white people about this. What about the idea of returning citizens? You know, we now say when people go to prison, they come back, and we need to do everything we can to support them to give them a second chance. A friend of mine said, how about returning citizens for former racist acts? That if people have conformed and improved their lives and done positive things, can we forgive them and allow them to go forward?
That's what the Reverend William Barber has been saying. We'll see how this all turns out, but that's all the time we have to discuss it right now. Toni Michelle Travis, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Toni Michelle Travis is the editor of the Almanac of Virginia Politics. She's a professor of political science at the Schar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University. Up next, Peter Newsham, the chief of the Metropolitan Police Department of the District of Columbia. Before we start talking to the chief, Tom, the D.C. Council has gone ahead and approved a sole source betting contract for the sports gambling in the city, and that sole source is Intralot, which currently runs the city's lottery. The city wanted to get this done in a hurry, so they said, let's do it with Intralot. But Moody's Investor Services has downgraded Intralot from B2 to B3, whatever that means, citing continuing negative free cash flow since 2015, expected to continue until 2020. But this is a done deal, isn't it?
Well, it's not a done deal, but I was told that there are only three firms in the world that would have bid on this contract if it were a bid, and all three of them have fairly weak financials. It did pass in the council 7-6 on Tuesday. It's probably going to come before the full council on February the 19th, although that date is not certain yet. But it looks like a majority of the council members, and 7 is the minimum you can have, want to go forward with sports betting, supporting Jeffrey DeWitt, the CFO, who says he normally doesn't like sole source contracts, but this is the best way for the city to proceed financially and involved. But there are a lot of business people in town, about a half dozen or so of them, who are still trying to get a piece of this. If they can undermine the sports betting thing, they will.
And on now to our next guest, Peter Newsham.
We have a little bit of breaking news. Can I just tell it real quick?
The Post
is reporting that Amazon is having second thoughts about going to New York. Unlike Virginia, which approved it.
The legislators in New York, right, a lot of them have been in opposition, right, to Amazon going there. It has not been the kind of smooth and easy sailing that's been experienced in Virginia. Yeah,
Patricia Sullivan and Robert McCartney and Jonathan O'Connell, all who've been on the show, have reported, and now it's being reported in New York too. This could mean something for Virginia.
On now to our next guest. Peter Newsham is the chief of police of the Metropolitan Police Department. Chief Newsham, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it, Kojo.
Good afternoon, Chief.
Tom, how are you?
I know you want to talk about homicides, but before we do that, this week Mayor Bowser announced the Felon in Possession Initiative. What is that initiative?
So that's a decision that's within the discretion of the U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia, Jesse Liu. And so what she has decided to do is she has decided to take all of the felon in possession cases incrementally and start prosecuting those cases in district court. What it means for the folks in the city is that there's going to be more of a focus on these particular offenses. One of the things, I don't know if this has been widely reported, is that we believe very strongly, and the data supports this, that our felons who are in possession of firearms in our community are responsible for a significant number of not only the homicides, but the shootings that are occurring in our city.
Well, why doesn't the city take control of that? Why allow the U.S. attorney to come up with an initiative that apparently forces the city to collaborate with the U.S. attorney on this and takes power away from D.C. Superior Court in these cases? Because the U.S. attorney apparently believes that D.C. Superior Court judges aren't imposing harsh enough penalties.
Well, I think that's a mischaracterization of what's going on. I think that there is a resource issue over at Superior Court right now because of a there's a number of judges that have not been appointed. There's a significant number of vacancies over there. As you know, the D.C. Superior Court has a large volume of cases that they're dealing with. I look at this more as a resource allocation, which is going to be in the best interest of the city. And I also know that any major city chief or any state in the country is always trying to leverage federal resources to assist with crime in their community. And, you know, for the U.S. attorney to do this on our behalf, is, I think, is going
to
be beneficial.
Well, how would you respond to this, Chief Newsham? We got a tweet from James Foreman, who is a former attorney in the District of Columbia and an author. He tweeted, "No, no, don't collaborate, Mayor Bowser. There's a book out there. I can't remember the title. Actually, the title is, because Foreman wrote the book, the title of the book is Locking Up Our Own. But that book is about how some black politicians in a previous generation bought into punitive logic and helped facilitate mass incarceration. Some in the last generation of black leaders did not understand the consequences of their actions. But you, Mayor Bowser, cannot claim ignorance. We now know that moving gun cases to federal courts will only bring longer sentences in more distant prisons with fewer programs." How would you respond to that, Chief Newsham?
Yeah, I think when you're talking about over-incarceration, and you just saw the federal government collaboratively passed a reform act with regards to criminal cases, is that what you see is that with over-incarceration is a lot of the incarceration was for nonviolent offenses. I think we have to be very careful to separate those folks in our community who are involved in violent acts. When you have a person who has been convicted of a felony, they've been afforded all of the opportunities that are afforded to criminal justice defendants in our system, and then they subsequently go out and they pick up a firearm. We have seen that a significant portion of those folks that are involved in that behavior of picking up a firearm after they have a felony conviction, that they're shooting and killing people in our community. And I don't think status quo is where we need to be right now. We had 160 homicides last year. 12 of those homicides, including the homicide of Micaiah Wilson, was committed by a felon who decided they were going to pick up a firearm and shoot it in our community. Sitting on our hands and doing nothing is not an option.
It's Tom Sherwood.
Chief, as I understand it, one of the reasons if the feds take over and to prosecute these felons in the subsequent cases, one of the reasons is because of the city's Youth Rehabilitation Act, which if you're in the Superior Court, there are more outs for the defendant to get.
I'm really glad you asked that question because you have heard that criticism, and that's just not true. If a person is going through the process of during their first conviction, they will be afforded the opportunity in Superior Court of all of the benefit of the Youth Rehabilitation Act. In a subsequent felony conviction, which picking up a firearm would be, there is rarely a case where a judge will offer the Youth Rehabilitation Act a second time. So anyone who's suggesting that these criminal defendants are not going to be afforded opportunities that they would be afforded over in D.C. Superior Court is just not being honest.
Go ahead.
Another question I asked some people who were involved in the city. They said, well, is this some kind of new kind of classic crackdown on crime? They said that look at even Mayor Bowser opposed the council's move to decriminalize fare jumpers on Metro, which is a very minor crime compared to what we're talking about. But there's when crime goes up, there's usually a push by officials and police to crack down on crime. And that's what we're doing. And less concerned about, again, the rehabilitation that people like to talk about.
This city has been, in my opinion, phenomenal in the opportunities that they afford to our returning citizens. Nobody, I think, and I don't want to speak for everyone, but I can tell you I am a proponent of affording our returning citizens all of the opportunities that they can have so they can be successful. I am friends with a number of returning citizens in this community. I went over to the D.C. jail to speak to some young guys that are over there who are 24 years of age and younger to discuss with them the importance of when they get out of seeking out those opportunities so they can come out into our community, return, and have a successful life, show them that there is a light at the end of the tunnel. But at the we cannot, in this community right now, tolerate a convicted felon who's going to come out here into our community, pick up a firearm, and shoot it in our community. People, I can tell you, I go across this city, they are tired of listening to gunshots. They are tired of seeing five-year-olds getting shot at bus stops. They are tired of burying 10-year-old girls because convicted felons are picking up firearms.
Well, like Nate, I said, Nate,
status quo is not right now. It's, we can't say we're going to do nothing.
Nate in Washington certainly seems to agree with you. Nate, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yes, thanks for taking the call. I just wanted to commend what the chief is saying. I think we're very in my community, we've been hearing a lot of frustration over the idea about folks who've been convicted of gun-related offenses coming back into the community again. And it's, I think, you know, the proof is that we're seeing an increase in homicides and gun-related homicides. And then I think the discussion about balancing the rights of folks, the civil liberties, and making sure that folks who have a chance, who are going into the system, have a chance for rehabilitation, is important. But it really needs to be balanced against the safety of our communities too. And so I'm happy to hear what the news that was reported by the chief today. So
Chief Newsom, Nate did mention that homicides in the district are on the rise. In 2018, they went up by about 40% compared to the year before. What do you think accounts for that uptick?
Well, you know, we're seeing, and that's a good question too, Kojo, is that we've looked back for the past 3 years. We've had just about the same number of shootings that we've had every year, a little over 500. And the lethality of the shootings has actually increased from a range of about 17 to 19% up to 23%. That increase in the lethality of our shootings has contributed to the rise in the homicides. Another piece to last year's homicide number was the fact that we had 13 prior year cases that were included in the 2018 numbers. But with all that being said, you talk about reducing it down by 13 or whatever the number is. Having as many homicides as we have in our city is too many. This city is too small. There's too few people to have that many homicides in this community. I think when we look at, a category of crimes where we're seeing a group of folks that we've identified who are involved in a behavior and we can somehow change that behavior, I think it's irresponsible of us not to do that.
Chief, you talk about the community support that you've got when you go around town and people want these types of horrible homicides and shootings to stop. There are also others, though, who complain the police department, despite changes in its attitude for the last 20 years, you've been on the force and know this, that it's still the police are still not as community-based as they ought to be. The city has the NEAR Act, as you know, and there's concerns about stop and frisk and other issues like that. Is the police department, I know you go to like events 5 nights a week, so I'm not saying this is a criticism of you, but is the police department doing enough to understand the changing nature of the community and the concerns people have?
I think it's a daily effort, and it's our responsibility as a department to be viewed in a positive light. So like we tell the police officers every day, any negative interaction that you have with the community is going to be amplified, and when you have a negative interaction with the community, everyone who's wearing this uniform is going to be viewed in that light. So it is it's a daily effort by us to improve our relationship in the community, to get our police officers out of the car. Frequently, we don't hear the good stories about our police. I hear them all the time. I couldn't be more proud to be able to sit as the chief of this agency. The stories that I hear, the things that our police officers do, sometimes they go out here and they take a lot of verbal abuse, our police officers, and they show amazing restraint that other human beings would never show. You have a remarkable police department. We're not perfect. We never claim to be. We're going to continue to listen to those concerns and do everything we can to improve that relationship.
Can I just very quick? I would say Jesse Liu is the U.S. attorney. I would feel better as a district citizen if the U.S. attorney for the district actually lived in the district. That's not a requirement. Some have, some have not. I just think, I don't know how much, she's fairly new, about a year or more in the job, I guess, now, but I don't know if she's getting out as much as you do in the Washington community to interact with citizens.
We got a tweet from Mysiki Valentine who says, what collaboration and data are being used from the Office of Neighborhood Safety and Engagement and the NEAR Act to create more progressive policies around policing? Police relations with the black community are crumbling, especially with the rising millennial population. Chief Nosham?
The work that the ONES office is doing and the violence interrupters, what they're doing out there in the community, I think in the long term is going to be extremely beneficial for reducing violence. You know, you'll hear us say it over and over again. There's no one thing that any organization can do to, you know, reduce the violence in our city. Some of this violence is for a host of reasons, probably the biggest reason being a lack of opportunity for folks. So you see, you watch Washington, D.C., you watch the way that we have changed from, you know, the late 80s through the 90s into this decade. It's all been in a very positive way. Violent crime has gone down dramatically in the past 10 years, so we have fewer victims of violent crimes. I like the fact that we are becoming less and less tolerant of gun violence, and we're all starting to focus on it. So I am completely accepting of the reforms that were implemented in the NEAR Act. I think that those violence interrupters and the things that Del McFadden is doing over at the ONES office is going to have a lot of positive results in our city.
Councilmember Allen, the chairman, Charles Allen, Ward 6, the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, put out a statement, I think today, maybe yesterday, raising some concerns about maybe this harsher move towards prosecution. And council member Robert White at large also has put out a statement. So several of the council members are concerned about this. Will there be more work with the council members to get them on board?
I think we go back to the decision to do this is within the discretion of the U.S. Attorney's Office. You know, whether you agree with it or not, I just have to say I agree. I think the collaboration that we're going to have with our federal agencies is much better for the city. We have federal law enforcement agencies that operate in our city on a daily basis, and they do a lot of different things. I have got commitments from the leadership of those federal law enforcement agencies that they are going to assist us with focusing on gun violence. To have the federal agencies focused on gun violence in our city, I don't think anyone would suggest is a bad thing. For the U.S. attorney to decide to bring a specific category of cases over to district court where consequences can be more swift and more certain, I think is very important for the city.
Running out of time very quickly. Okay. Here's Rick in Washington, D.C. Rick, your turn.
Good afternoon, Chief, and good afternoon, Kojo. I'm a defense attorney in D.C. and have been so for the last 20 years, and I don't agree with a lot of the things the chief is saying here, and it's just not accurate. One, you can get the Youth Act twice from a judge. It's on a case. Every case is on a case by case.
But
basis.
Like I said, Rick, we're running out of time very quickly.
We got a tweet from
Siri that said the chief's stats seem to show that very few convicted felons are committing these crimes. Didn't he just say 12 of the 160 murders were from convicted felons? That's less than 10%. Rick, that's one I thought you wanted to raise also.
Yeah, and I do. Can I just
well, allow the chief to respond because we're almost out of time.
Yeah, clear. It's got to be clear, Kojo. That's 12 of the known people that were arrested for homicides. It's about 24%. 24% of the known homicide offenders last year were felons who picked up a firearm, shot, and killed somebody, including Micaiah Wilson.
And this is as much to send a message as you said to going to talk to people in prison or in jail. This you're trying to send a message to people that the sentences are going to be tougher.
I wasn't trying to send a message to those guys over at D.C. jail. What I was trying to show them is that there is light at the end of the tunnel, that the D.C. government is going to do everything that they possibly can to help those young men succeed when they get out of jail. There's no message trying to be sent, and I am hopeful that each and every one of them, when they do get out of jail, becomes a successful returning citizen.
Peter Newsham is the Chief of Police of the Metropolitan Police Department. Chief Newsham, thank you for joining us.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks, Chief.
Tom Sherwood, we lost Frank Robinson this week. Oh. Frank Robinson was the first manager of the Washington Nationals when they first came to Washington and was still playing at RFK Stadium. He was also at Hall of Fame player.
I encourage people to, if you go on BaltimoreSun.com, they have great stories in the Baltimore Sun paper. There are several good pieces in the Washington Post. Remarkable man, tough. You didn't want to get on his wrong side if you were a player or a fan, but he was a tough guy. And he said he was only the first black manager in baseball because his skin was black.
Today's Politics Hour was produced by Mark Gunnery. At the end of the month, we'll take our show to Silver Spring and cover school diversity as part of the Kojo 20 Anniversary Event Series. You can register for free at kojoshow.org. In the lead-up to our roadshow, we'll be diving into education issues around the region. On Monday, we'll discuss school redistricting in Arlington County. Will it solve the district's overcrowding problem? Program? Will redrawing the school boundary lines actually fit the needs of students? Join us Monday at noon. Until then, thank you for listening. I'm Kojo Nami.
The Kojo Namdi Show is produced by Ruth Tam, Mark Gunnery, Julie Deppenbrock, and Margaret Barthel. Our managing producer is Angelisa Schrobstorff, and our senior producer is Mana Kashvi. Our intern is Sydney Grannon, and our engineer is Josephine Neonai. For past shows and more content, visit kojoshow.org.
Thanks for listening to the Kojo Namdi Show, and if you're already a member of WAMU 88.5, thank you for your support. If not, it's easy to give online at wamu.org. Just click the donate button, and thanks.